This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
We're going to start with the knockout blow suffered by the British royal family this week, thanks to a high-profile interview with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Harry and Meghan. For this story, we'll go straight to Richard.
Yes, if you've not heard about the interview, you probably spent the week living under a rock. This was just about everywhere Sunday evening. This interview was played with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex sitting down with Oprah Winfrey, I guess the queen of American TV confessionals. And I think the biggest story that they dropped there is they basically said that the royal family is racist. The message that they came with, that they very heavily implied, was that the royal family deliberately changed the rules so that Archie would not be a prince, and that they did that because he would be black, and that they were concerned that they couldn't have somebody with dark skin be a prince. The other thing they said is that they didn't provide him with security either, kind of implying, well, the royal family didn't really care if he lived or died because they hate people of different races. This was, there were other big bombshell revelations in this, but that is the thing that has had real staying power and has rocketed around the world, this message that the royal family is fundamentally racist.
There's so much to unpack in this story. There's only so much that we can cover. I think Stephen Fleury's been doing a great job on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You are working on an article for the upcoming print edition. Before we get into more of the details here, I'd like to just address the issue of why is the Trumpet covering this? We are not a gossip tabloid. This really is a serious story with serious implications. Help us to understand, Richard.
I think, firstly, just this story is so... I think some of the royal family stories, I think, could be dismissed as mere gossip. This is so big that even just from a news perspective, this is going to have ramifications. This idea that the foundational institution of Britain is fundamentally racist. You're having discussions now in all of these countries around the world that... You know, the Queen is the head of state of a whole number of Caribbean countries, of African countries. This is prompting all of these questions about, well, do we really even need to be associated with that throne anymore? This is a royal family news story that is so big that it is going to affect world news. But then there is an even deeper, more important factor in this. You know, we analyze world news in the light of what the Bible says, and the Bible has a lot to say about the throne in Britain. You know, the Bible talks about, there are very clear prophecies in the Bible that talk about God giving a throne to David and that this throne lasting forever. There always being a descendant sitting on that throne, ruling somewhere. And Mr. Armstrong, in his book, United States and Britain in Prophecy, goes into that in much more detail. It shows how we can't kind of spiritualize this prophecy away and say that it's all fulfilled in Christ. There's something much more specific here. And he proves that the Britain's royal family are sitting on that throne. So this is a family that is talked about in the Bible and that the Bible actually gives a lot of importance to. Mr. Fleury talks about this in his booklet on Jeremiah, because Jeremiah has a lot to say about this throne. And he says there is a direct connection between the unrighteousness surrounding David's throne in England and the death of America and Britain. And he's written another book now that's got more up-to-date truth, The New Throne of David, on that throne. But that point that there is a connection between what happens on that throne and Britain and America is still something very important. And it's no coincidence. I think that you kind of had Meghan Markle this time last year starting to imply that Britain is racist and the press is racist. And that that played a big role in bringing some of these George Floyd fallouts and Black Lives Matter over into the UK. Hmm. I think prior to that, there's kind of been this view in the UK that, OK, America's racist. They've got a legacy of slavery and things like that. But we didn't have that same history here in Britain. That's an American story. It doesn't affect us. And last year, she really had, and she played a huge role in changing that narrative, bringing, importing in some of those kind of riots and some of that kind of racial politics to the UK. And then this has really ramped that up several notches. I mean, it is, like I said, an attack on Britain's foundational institution. I mean, if the royal family is racist, if the Queen is racist, then there is no question Britain is institutionally racist at that point. And then, well, of course, radical changes need to be made. This whole system needs to be transformed. You can see how so much revolves around that one point.
You know, the fact that she is saying what she is saying is bad. But to me, the bigger story here really is the reception that this interview has received in the American press and largely in the British press as well. I mean, to hear a woman who came into the royal family of her own volition and was a part of the royal family for 2 or 3 years and receiving, you know, the kind of privilege and success that people literally dream about. I am dumbfounded that the universal response to what she is saying here is not, well, you were a princess, you know, living in a palace, and you're saying your life was so hard that you wanted to kill yourself. You've got to be kidding. I'll take some of that oppression that you were suffering. That is not the response. The response is, wow, this proves just how fatally flawed this institution was, and all of these people that are so wholeheartedly buying that narrative, which is demonstrably false, is just remarkable.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think I underestimated how big this story was at first for exactly that reason. You know, I kind of thought her claims were so ridiculous and so obviously untrue that everyone would just dismiss them. I mean, this idea that Archie isn't a prince because of racism, that's demonstrably false. There are the rules for who gets to be a prince were set down over 100 years ago. And it was very clear. It didn't matter who Harry married. Prince Harry married his first son was not going to be a prince until after the Queen died. That's the rules. That's the way it's been for a long time. There is no question of this having been changed because of racism or something like it. It's false. And so much of what they brought up in the interview was false. You know, when they were trying to paint the UK media as being racist, a third of the headlines they showed proving racism were from not the UK media, from outside. And then even the ones they did show, they had to doctor and change to make it look like there was racism. They lied. Oprah's production team and whatever, they were lying. And it was very obviously lying. Yet anybody that points this out, I mean, you're right, there's the overwhelming kind of response from the American media. Some of the, just even the headlines, I was astonished. Some of the, coming out of the New York Times and some of those other publications, Foreign Policy, Meghan Markle's revelation in Oprah's interview have destroyed Black Britons' trust in the monarchy. You know, that article said, this is racism, serious and potentially deadly racism. At the very pinnacle of Britain and the Commonwealth. The New York Times had an article, Meghan and Harry's interview shows the monarchy must go. You know, to those writers, there's no question.
Yeah.
And then you get to some of these UK media, you know, Piers Morgan saying the same thing that you basically said there, you know, I don't believe her. There are a lot of good reasons not to believe her. She's saying she had no one to talk to and that she was suicidal while simultaneously campaigning with mental health professionals to raise awareness on, you know, she was sitting down doing interviews with the same experts that she said she didn't have access to. He says he doesn't believe her and he loses his job. Or you have Ian Murray, executive director of the Society of Editors, writing an article defending the British press, which as the head of the Society of Editors, when somebody makes a false accusation, that's his job.
Yeah.
You would expect him to do that. He loses his job. I think the stats show that the majority of the public that they've polled in Britain support the Queen. But if you look at people under, I think, 44, that's not true. And then you certainly look at all of these people in positions of power, like the media, and then many in the left-wing politicians and things like that, they're right on board with her, despite it just being so clearly untrue. So, yeah, it says a lot about Meghan Markle. It probably says even more about our society and those people in positions of power.
It really does. After everything that has happened over this last year, where we have seen the mainstream media latch on to these narratives on the subjects like coronavirus, and we've seen it with climate change, we've seen it with transgenderism and so many other things. We've seen it with the election in the United States, where once they decide this is the way that this is going to be reported, it is all facts pushed aside with, you know, absolute impunity, no regard for the truth whatsoever. Like Isaiah 59 says, truth is fallen in the street. The narrative is the dominant position that prevails regardless of anything else. We're seeing this here again. It's really hard to take. But it is like, as Gerald Flory said when he was writing about that new throne of David, that this there was going to be a rapid decline in the royal family in Britain. We've seen that happen dramatically this past week. Richard wrote about this in the Trumpet Brief on Monday. This is our free email service that we will give to you for free if you are interested. The title of that was Meghan Markle Accuses Royals of Racism. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. But we'd also encourage you to look at that booklet from Gerald Flory, The New Throne of David, to put all of this in its broader prophetic context. Thank you very much for that, Richard. So much information is coming out about just how pro-Iran the new Biden administration is. We have a dramatic story later in the program about billions of dollars in frozen assets that are now being released to Iran. This influx of cash and the loss of America's support against Iran makes it even more critical that Israel defend itself against the Islamic Republic. And this week, it was doing just that. To learn how, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, the Wall Street Journal came out with a stunning report on March 11th that detailed the fact that Israel has targeted at least a dozen Iranian vessels through various means that were carrying both weapons and oil. We don't know. It was pretty vague, the report, to determine whether there were weapons on the oil ships that were targeted by Israel, or these were two separate types of vessels that were targeted by Israel. But this includes Israel targeting them everywhere from the Red Sea, so down towards Yemeni, Saudi Arabian territory, or at least off the coast of those nations, all the way up into the Mediterranean. And these vessels, it's been widely known that Iran is supplying oil to the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, and that's under international sanctions. So it's illegal to sell oil to Bashar al-Assad, and this is voted on by the UN. And so Iran has been trying to go around that, and Israel, it seems, is trying to put a stop to that in lieu of the fact that the international community is giving Iran and Syria a free ride. No one else is willing to stand up for international law, so Israel has been attacking these vessels. Now, Israel has to be careful. They haven't been attacking them to the point that they would stink, obviously, or produce a disaster. However, two of the vessels have had to return back to Iran for repairs. But in a way, it's Israel's way of saying that if the world is not going to stop this, we are going to stop it, or at least attempt to, this illicit trade and or the supplying of weapons to Bashar al-Assad and or Hezbollah as well into Lebanon.
So there's quite a lot of activity going on here between Israel and Iran. This report kind of lifts the lid on something that we haven't realized, just the degree to which these two have been engaging each other on the open sea.
Right. And I mean, obviously the Americans knew about this because it goes back to 2019. President Trump would have been on board with this. There is some indication, this article, that American intelligence did help out Israel determining which ones of these ships belong to Iran. The difficulty is a lot of these ships don't have their transponders on when they travel, especially as they're traveling through the Suez Canal. And they're going blind. They're just, at least to international observers and tankers, watches, things like that. So Israel has had the all clear, obviously, from the United States to act in this way, and then also from the Saudis to act in this way as well, and perhaps even the Egyptians. So this has been a secret for the past year and a half that Israel has been acting in this way against Iran. For whatever reason, the Wall Street Journal received this exclusive report based on unnamed American officials at this time. And it seems like Israel did not want the cover to be blown off this story. They often would rather act clandestinely and covertly, continue the way that they have been, as just a warning to Iran. Because when Iran now the world knows that Israel is attacking Iran, then Iran has to save face with its own type of attacks against Israel. And so Israel would rather act inside the shadows. Now, this was a story that came out of the United States, and the U.S. released this story to the Wall Street Journal. And so perhaps it is, there might be something a bit more nefarious going on here than just good reporting, finding out a scoop, but that the U.S. military wanted to expose Israel, the fact that Israel is doing this. Like, this does come at a very interesting time as well, because over the past month, there have been two separate attacks of Iran on Israeli vessels. One of them took place on an Israeli-owned cargo ship in the Gulf of Oman, just after it exited the Persian Gulf. And this was possibly a mine attack on the side of the ship, the Limpet mines, and that ship had to go into a port in the UAE to get repairs before it made its way back towards Israel. And then there was another very interesting an attack that the Israeli environmental minister is calling eco-terrorism, when there was a vessel that was... that released oil, an Iranian-owned vessel that released oil into the Eastern Mediterranean back on February 22nd and 23rd, and that closed down Israel's beaches for a week, with tar showing rocking up on the soil. All this wildlife was killed. And it turns out, at least the tourism ministry of Israel came out and said that this was a purposeful leak of oil off the coast of Israel by an Iranian tanker en route to Syria. And we know that this was definitely, we've got confirmation that this was an Iranian tanker that offloaded the rest of its cargo inside Syria. And so you have two very pretty public attacks on Israel using attacks on Israel ships or an attack on an Iranian ship releasing oil to the Eastern Med in the past month. And then all of a sudden we have an exposure of Israel's attacks on Iran ships that comes about because of American officials telling the Wall Street Journal.
So the what you're implying is that maybe there are American officials that are trying to expose this to create some sort of sense of equivalency between what Iran did and what Israel is doing.
And that's, yes, I am saying that. I mean, this is not surprising. This is what the United States has sought to do with Saudi Arabia, and they are actively working in this way. And that's what Barack Obama did with Saudi Arabia, telling, you know, that you're basically the same. You've got to work out your give us some type of Cold War scenario here, Saudi Arabia and Iran. Share the neighborhood, sort out your distance differences. Like, it's both are equally evil,
right?
And it's one is not an aggressor and one is not defending itself. And so if it does that, then it raises Iran's, the worldwide, let's say, a worldwide opinion of Iran based on what the United States says, that it is not uniquely evil in the Middle East. It is actually the same as everybody else. And so coming out with this story in a month after two stories of Israeli vessels being attacked, it seems like the United States is trying to give Iran a bit of a boost here, I would say that they are partially justified, at least in attacking Israeli vessels, because Israel's been doing it to Iran for the past year and a half.
You know, I suppose this is a story that changes in the eye of the beholder. When I look at this information, I think for as pro-Iran as the Biden administration has been, the fact that Israel would be taking these kinds of measures as part of a comprehensive effort to defend itself against what is certain to be an ascendant Iran is unsurprising. And what other choice do we give Israel but to do something like this? And the fact that it exposes Iran's efforts to circumvent the economic measures that have been put in place to try to isolate it, it's been looking to get around those and export its oil and export its weapons and continue its terrorist sponsoring activities. There's plenty here that shows that Israel is perfectly justified to do what it's doing. But the fact that if there is this element of trying to undermine Israel on the part of American officials, in a way, it just underscores the need for this type of thing on Israel's part.
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, Israel has said they're willing to act alone against Iran if they have to, and this kind of does prove it that they will. Even you know, attacking ships in the Red Sea—that's a pretty big deal. I did want to just mention quickly that as the United States is kind of allowing Israel to act in this way by itself, you did have another a joint Navy exercise this week take place in the Eastern Mediterranean. A lot of where these ships are traveling through, Iranian ships are traveling through en route to Syria. There was also Israel, Greece, Cyprus, and France conducting Navy maneuvers together, acting in one accord. The United States usually acts inside these maneuvers each year. They didn't this year. Instead, France is there, which is just interesting in looking at biblical prophecy, where we know that the United States is not going to stand in Iran's way to slow down what Iran is doing, but it's going to be Europe that does step in that regard to help out Israel and to look to Israel as a friend. Israel's going to look to Europe as a friend in the face of the Iranian threat. And just as they're acting alone this week, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, attacking these Iranian ships, you have them training with the European navies as well. And that is something to watch for going forward, that kind of collaboration increasing. If people want to read more about that, this aspect of Europe coming into the Iranian fray, our trends article is very important relating to this. It's entitled Europe and Iran Heading for a Clash of Civilizations.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. China's military ascendance continues, and China's president is keen to keep his foot on the gas pedal. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Tuesday, during China's annual parliament session, President Xi Jinping held a special panel discussion with some of the top brass from the People's Liberation Army. And his message really emphasized that the current security situation for China is unstable and uncertain. And Xi said that the Chinese military at every branch, at every level, needs to be combat ready. I'll go through just a couple of the more dramatic statements that he made during this speech. In one part, he said, "The entire military must coordinate the relationship between capacity building and combat readiness. We must be prepared to respond to a variety of complex and difficult situations at any time, resolutely safeguard national sovereignty and security, and provide strong support for the comprehensive construction of a modern socialist state." And then from there, he talked about the need for China to accelerate the modernization of the military. He gave quite a lot of emphasis to the need for more innovation, which in Chinese terms basically means stealing technology from more advanced countries like the United States and reverse engineering it. But, you know, that method, however unethical, has been quickly closing the technology gap for China. And then the Chinese defense minister also spoke, and he said China's national security has now entered what he called a high-risk phase. One of the memorable lines from his address said, "The great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation is at a critical stage. We are facing unprecedented opportunities as well as unprecedented challenges." And then from there, he released kind of a battle cry about improving training and preparedness so that China can, quote, prevail over our strong enemies. You know, so the U.S. isn't specifically named there, but that's obviously who he's talking about. So this is some very bold rhetoric, some very candid language from the Chinese leadership, and it shows that we should only expect China's aggression to increase in the months and years ahead.
What are China's specific military goals? What is he trying to pursue here above all, do you think?
Yeah, well, at this panel discussion, they actually did discuss some of their specific goals and challenges. They talked about the Himalayan border dispute that China has with India. You know, last year, those tensions were really soaring, and even though they did come to a peace agreement last month, that's something that could explode back into conflict at any time. And then they also discussed China's tensions with Japan over the East China Sea and territories that both of them claim there. And they talked quite a bit about China's rivalry with the United States, especially in terms of how that connects to Taiwan, which China is bent on, you know, bringing back into the fold. And then they gave even more attention to the South China Sea. That's an area that's become far more important to China in recent years, especially since they've built and militarized several islands in the waters there. So China's really been stepping up its air and naval operations in the South China Sea. And if this panel discussion is any indication, I think we can expect China's, you know, its takeover of that area to become even more aggressive going forward.
How do you view these announcements and this meeting that they had and what she is talking about in light of biblical prophecy?
Yeah, well, this is something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has actually written specifically about in the context of Bible prophecy. He wrote an article in our July 2016 issue calling attention especially to China's takeover of the South China Sea and its general increase in militarism, the rise of its military power, but mainly in that vital waterway. And he really contrasted China's rising power with America's declining power there. One section of that article, it says, "Since World War II, America has protected this vital trade route and brought peace to this part of the world. But now the American military is retreating, and China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. It's forcing these countries to do it at once. Everything is headed in the direction of war." And Mr. Fleury explained that the reason why he thinks that's heading toward war, and really his whole understanding of the China dynamic there, is founded on Bible prophecy. He called a lot of attention to a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28. This is a passage where God addresses the nations of Israel, which in this context mainly means modern America and Britain. And God warns them that if they do not turn to him, then he'll transfer control over the world's most important maritime locations and control points or gates to their enemies. Today we see Xi Jinping stepping up military operations in and around the gates to the South China Sea. We see him telling his huge army to be combat ready at all levels. And that's all happening in areas that just a few years ago were under de facto control of America and Britain. So this really shows that this prophecy in Deuteronomy is now in the process of being fulfilled in this location.
China is steering the world toward war, is the article from Gerald Fleury that we will link to in the show notes. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. The presidency of Joe Biden is so unusual in so many ways, and one of these is the curious role that his vice president is playing in America's foreign policy. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Vice President Kamala Harris has been playing a major role in shaping White House foreign policy. There was actually an article published this week in the Washington Post entitled "Harris is playing an unusually large role in shaping Biden's foreign policy." And that article goes through several things unusual in American politics. The fact that that Harris has met with, I think, at least six world leaders alone, including some big names like Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, French President Emmanuel Macron, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Norway, And these are the types of meetings that normally, especially this early in an administration, that the president would be doing. Maybe late in the administration, the presidents might start delegating some more special projects to the vice president. But at this point, when the Biden administration is really establishing some of the relationships with these nations for the first time, it would be customary for the president to be doing these meetings and not Vice President Harris. That Washington Post article also highlights the fact that she's keeping a regular schedule of meetings with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and other officials, just trying to formulate the new Biden-Harris domestic policies as well, in a way that is just really unusual for having this much influence this early in an administration. Though while it's unusual, it shouldn't necessarily be surprising. I think we've mentioned on this show before that, like, all the way back in June, the investigative journalist Lee Smith wrote an article for The Tablet kind of outing the fact that Harris was Barack Obama's first choice for presidential candidate. Now, she was ranked as, depending on the ranking, as either the most radical leftist or the second most radical leftist senator in Congress. Mm-hmm. And so she didn't do well in the primary, even amongst Democrats. Only like 1% of the people voted for them. They preferred someone who appeared more moderate, like Biden. But by having Biden actually get the nomination and then putting Harris on the ticket, they kind of snuck her in the White House
right
through the back door.
Yep.
And now that I guess there's not been a don't want to spread rumors. I don't know if there's been an official medical diagnosis, but several commentators have pointed out that Biden's been making some gaffes and slips, which are consistent with the signs of like the early onset of dementia. Mm-hmm. That, like, given his age, his mind may be going. And so, which would make it that much easier for Harris to kind of really rule like a shadow president. And given her ideological alignment with Barack Obama, that would be like Barack Obama being the real shadow president, but kind of like his woman on the inside, where as Biden gets to the point where he just seems like he doesn't know what's going on.
It really is so strange to watch Joe Biden speak and to think this man just took office, you know, 50 days ago. It's very difficult not to see these signs that you're talking about, that he's just a man in decline, which makes all of these machinations going on behind the scenes and Kamala Harris taking this kind of a role within the administration, considering how radical that she is, that much more concerning. Really, looking at all of this, prophetically speaking, is so critical. I think the last two issues, or even three issues, of the Philadelphia Trumpet giving the prophetic view of what's going on are very important. Our April 2021 edition had the article from Stephen Fleury, A Nation Destroying Presidency, that talked about just how active Barack Obama has been in orchestrating the Biden presidency. You see so many of his staffers that are, again, in prominent roles within this administration. And watching this unfold truly is remarkable. I would encourage you to go look at that article, A Nation Destroying Presidency. We'll link to it in the show notes for the program today. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Iran beginning to receive billions of dollars as frozen assets are released, Russia's impressive international military exercises, Switzerland banning the burqa, and the possibility that America could soon experience Venezuelan-style inflation. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Trump administration achieved considerable success in isolating Iran economically, but billions of dollars in frozen assets are now being unfrozen and are making their way into Iranian leaders' hands. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a really surprising report that came out over the past, let's say, week. It's not getting picked up in too many places, it seems, although you do have the Koreans and the Iraqis and the Omanis all assenting that there is money on the way to Iran. This is money that it was a result of purchased oil from the Iranians that the just came under sanction by the Trump administration, meaning that Iran had unloaded the oil in these separate countries, but these countries were unable to pay them back for the oil. So essentially what we have now is the start of these IOUs for payment for oil returning to Iran. Now, up to this point, there's reports, and the Iranians have said that $3 billion has arrived in Iran already. Some of that's from South Korea, some of that's from Iraq, and some of that's from Iran, and that there is more on the way as well. They also said that the United States had to have signed off on this, or else it could not have been released at all by the South Koreans. The South Koreans said this already also, that it wasn't going to be released. Now, the last day, it seems that Secretary of State Blinken has not confirmed this is happening. He looks to be wanting to distance himself from this story to say that it's not true. So we do have a kind of their word against America's word against Iran's word, and also what the Koreans are saying as well. But it is very interesting because this is before nuclear negotiations have began with Iran and the United States. And yet it looks like some of these money, to the tune of billions of dollars, is already making its way back to Iran.
You said billions of dollars. How many billions are we talking about here?
It looks to be a figure around $15 billion from these three nations that is going to be given back to Iran or paid to Iran. And that's just had the first installment of that. Now, that only refers to these three specific nations. There's plenty of others that have got money frozen right now, Iranian money that they owe Iran that was frozen because of Trump's sanctions, and perhaps that would come back fast as well. When we talk about these frozen funds, that's similar to the $150 billion that Iran got for negotiating the nuclear deal back by Barack Obama in 2015, 2016. They got $150 billion of unfrozen monies. So it's hard to know how much is going to be contained in these unfrozen amounts that come back to Iran. We know of about $15 billion from these three nations. Now, what's interesting, what forced the hand here is that back in January, you had the Iranians that petitioned South Korea. They said, Biden's in power, give us our money back right now, he won't stop you, basically. And the South Koreans were said, well, we can't give it up until America officially allows us to do it. And so what did the Iranians do? They hijacked a South Korean ship down in Southeast Asia. They send their minions over there, hijack a ship, and they take the crew prisoner until South Korea agrees that they're going to pay them the first installment of $1 billion. And South Korea does agree to do it, and saying that the U.S. has to sign off on it as well, and Iran lets the crew go. So this is the type of maneuvers Iran is making to get access to this money, and it seems like the United States lacks a lot of cards in its hands to stop them from getting this money if their intent is to negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran.
Right.
Again,
if they're giving all of this up before the negotiations even begin, it gives you a real clear idea of what they plan to do in those negotiations.
Right. And that's no surprise to anybody. We expect that. And whether we actually see a nuclear deal or not, it does not matter. Iran is going to keep on acting in this way. They're going to find ways to get money. And right now, if you look at the amount of oil that China has bought, off the kind of in the black market over the past from Iran in the past 2 months. It's astronomical. They are getting a lot of Iran's oil. Iran is going to get that money back. And what does the United States? What can the United States do right now? Are they going to actually sanction Iranian officials in further ways? Are they going to send secondary sanctions on insurers that try to insure these ships? They're without many cards to play to stop Iran from doing this, given their desire for a nuclear deal. And that is what we expect going forward. We expect the United States to give Iran cover, to get the money that it needs to do what it wants, to do what it always does with the money that it receives. We have written a little bit about this of late in the last Trumpet magazine. We did have an article about this, Barack Obama's kind of foreign policy referring to Iran and how that it is back in the Middle East. And people can certainly read that article if they want more details.
The title of that article, Middle East Allies Be Warned, Obama is Back. And also, Brent has written an article that is up at the Trumpet site right now. Under Biden, billions have already returned to Iran. Go check that out. Thank you very much, Brent. We spoke in the first half about China's impressive military posturing. We'll look now at Russia, which is holding an impressive number of international military drills this year. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the commander of Russia's Central Military District announced Tuesday that throughout the course of this year, the Central District will be holding 23 joint international exercises, including six with the militaries of foreign nations. So the Central Military District is the largest in Russia. It's based mainly around the Ural Mountains and Siberia, and it actually has quite a few installations abroad as well. It has a sizable presence in Tajikistan. It also has the Kant base there in Kyrgyzstan, and several different facilities in Kazakhstan, too. So this is it's really the heart of Russia's armed forces in some meaningful ways, and they will be holding joint military drills, basically, you know, practicing for war this year with India, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, and, of course, China. So, you know, just a really jam-packed schedule this year that was just announced for Russia's Central Military District. And then if you zoom out a bit to look at other districts of the Russian military, there are also military drills planned with all kinds of other foreign nations this year. Several major games are on the schedule with Belarus, and then also some exercises are planned with Armenia, Sri Lanka, Laos, Mongolia, and Vietnam. So, you know, the Russian military is really involved with a huge number, a rare number, really, of other countries' militaries here.
There's a lot of military cooperation among these Asian nations, and it seems like every time we hear a story about this, Russia is always at the center of all of it. Is that perception accurate?
I think it is. Very often that is the case, and I think that takes on a lot of significance in the context of Bible prophecy. Anyone who has listened to the Trumpet Hour for, you know, any amount of time really will be acquainted with the scriptures in the book of Revelation about a pan-Asian military superpower that is to emerge in the modern era. This is a group of Asian countries that's called the Kings of the East. And we know from prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and 39 that this Asian army will be led by Russia. And then the passages there also give us names that correspond to modern China and India and other Asian nations to show that they will be under Russia's power in this Kings of the East bloc. So this will be just an unfathomably powerful and huge military machine. And I think that all these war drills that Russia is participating in this year with these other Asian nations, it's very significant when you think about those scriptures, because it shows that this primary king of the Kings of the East is already rehearsing for war and preparing to fight alongside the other Kings of the East nations. The focus of Putin's Russia more and more seems to be on fighting a major war allied with other Asian powers. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we would expect from the Kings of the East prophecies.
You know, Gerald Flory has talked about that when he has spoken about Vladimir Putin being that prophesied Prince of Rosh, that we are seeing the forces of these Asian hordes that are prophesied in the book of Revelation They're there. When you look at these combined military drills and you see all of these Asian nations that are cooperating so closely together militarily, it is especially chilling when you view it in light of those prophecies that you're mentioning.
Yes, it really does seem to be setting the stage for exactly what we're watching for.
Well, we have an article up at thetrumpet.com, Russia to Host War Exercises Fit for Kings, by Rufaro Manyepa. You can read that there at the website, and we'll link to it in our show notes, and also Gerald Flory's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Europeans are increasingly concerned about the growing presence and influence of Islam within their nations. This week, Switzerland took a measure that is certain to accelerate the timetable for a confrontation. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Switzerland has a pretty unique constitution in that they hold frequent referendums, and the majority can use it to make the government do things that your politicians wouldn't typically do. And they used that power most recently on March 7th, when the country voted to ban the wearing of full face coverings in public. For legal reasons, these laws are generally worded so that they're neutral like that. You know, the idea of singling out a specific religion is not compatible with the human rights legislation that covers most of Europe. But everybody knows of it as the burqa ban. It's a ban aimed specifically at Muslim face veils. And similar bans you've had come into place in France, Austria, the Netherlands, and Denmark. I think an interesting part or an interesting aspect of this story is Switzerland the Muslim minority in Switzerland isn't huge, certainly not as big as it is in some of these other countries, especially those featuring face coverings. But they still felt strongly enough about this to force a referendum and to vote it in favor. So this is just another classic example of the kind of the rise of this identity politics in Europe, but identity politics, I guess, different to the way it's normally used, where it's all about accentuating these different symbols, embracing Christian symbols because that's Europe's heritage, and explicitly rejecting Muslim symbols because that's something alien to Europe.
Well, it is interesting this is coming out of Switzerland, because of all of the headlines that we've read over the past several years of fairly public confrontations, terrorist attacks that are happening in these nations where you have people that are really upset at the presence of Muslims within their nation or how they're taking over, and you see, minarets going up and that type of thing, mosques. We haven't heard about Switzerland. Why is it that, one of the safest countries in Europe is taking this measure? What does it say more generally?
Well, actually, they did vote to ban minarets a few years ago in a similar referendum. I mean, I think their reflection on what all of Europe thinks, I think a lot of pretty much all European countries, I think, would probably vote for a similar law in a referendum. But Switzerland's constitution allows that to go ahead and allows the majority to express that opinion in a way that other countries don't. So I think it reflects just a groundswell of anti— well, I don't know whether it goes so far as, say, anti-Islam, but this belief in the importance of these symbols and emphasizing that we are Christian countries and we have a Christian heritage. And it's this kind of clash, this ideological clash between Islam and Christianity that we have been talking about for a long time on the Trumpet website. We have a whole booklet, The King of the South. I think we already mentioned that on this show, that talks about this building clash between Europe, specifically between a Catholic-led power in Europe and a radical Islamic power in the Middle East. And it's really interesting to see these two powers rising in tandem. And as radical Islam becomes stronger and more frequent or makes the news more frequently, you see Europe responding by taking these kind of measures and then doing things to emphasize its Christian nature. So you can see these two coming to a clash, and as the King of the South booklet brings out, that clash is prophesied very specifically in the Bible.
Well, we have an article up at thetrumpet.com, Switzerland Bans the Burqa, by Daniel DeSanto. Go check that out. And we'll also link to the King of the South, as Richard just mentioned in the show notes for today's program. Thank you, Richard. One final story, with Democrats passing another $2 trillion bill, supposedly to address COVID. Alarm bells are ringing about the effect that all this money printing will have on the value of America's currency. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the television show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was once really popular in Venezuela until everyone in Venezuela became a millionaire. Their hyperinflation crisis has gotten so bad there that the bolivar has become practically worthless. Actually, on March 5th, the Central Bank of Venezuela announced that it was introducing a 1 million bolivar note. So anyone can be a millionaire with just one banknote in their hand. But it's only worth, in purchasing power, about 53 U.S. cents. That would be about a postage stamp and a half, I guess, if you wanted to buy something with it. Mm. And that's all due to just the deficit spending and the money printing that's been going on in Venezuela. Their socialist policies crashed their economy. They've been going into debt year after year. In order to pay the debts, they've been printing money. And then the more they print, the less their currency becomes. And to where now, like I said, yeah, you've got a million bolivars is worth about half a dollar. But the interesting thing, as you brought up at the beginning, is that Senator Rand Paul has noted that the United States is kind of on the same path. He said this week that this new million bolivar note in Venezuela is worth 53 cents. Will the United States be the next Venezuela, with Congress borrowing over $6 trillion in 1 year? And he made that comment right after they passed that $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, pointing out that last year, between the COVID relief and the other spending, you spent $6 trillion. So America's doing the same type of deficit spending and money printing that Venezuela's doing. Now, we kind of get away with it because since the dollar's the reserve currency, the more we go into debt, people and institutions and nations keep buying up our debt in terms of the U.S. Treasury securities. But when that stops, or when the debt level gets so high that people stop doing that, and some pretty famous investors have come out in the last several days, including Michael Burry, who predicted the 2008 stock market crash, saying that that is exactly what they expect to happen. As the U.S. debt level gets so high, you will have people stop buying the Treasury bonds. The market will crash. You'll lose that shield that has protected us from the Venezuela-style consequences, and you will see inflation start getting out of control.
There's enough precedents. There are enough examples that are along the lines of Venezuela that these politicians who are passing these bills and just printing money without compunction should know better. Are they trying to break? Are they trying to break the value of the dollar?
That is an interesting question. I mean, there's definitely those who've speculated that they thought that, like those who are into digital currencies or cryptocurrencies, Venezuela's moving towards that. That if you could purposely break the dollar, you could move to a new digital system or something like that. So, I mean, that has been thrown out there. I think the more common the more common explanation is just selfishness, and that a lot of these politicians, they seem to think that it's almost like robbing your children or your grandchildren. It's like a lot of the senators are elderly and figure that well, they can live high on the hog well beyond their means, and it won't be till the next generation that you have to solve these nation-destroying problems.
What's remarkable is that $1.9 trillion, 91% of it isn't even being used for COVID relief.
Right.
It's just dumbfounding to see how the way that these lawmakers are being so cavalier about America's currency, about America's future.
Yeah, it is amazing to see, but it is prophesied. I mean, there's in Deuteronomy, you have the blessings and cursings chapter, and one of the cursings for a nation that disobeys God is that other nations will lend to you and you won't lend to them. And so if people are lending to you and you're not lending to them, that just do the math, it means you're in debt. So, I mean, the national debt is prophesied as one of those curses. And the late Herbert W. Armstrong always, at least strongly, speculated. I think our editor-in-chief has even referred to it as a personal prophecy, and that it's not necessarily explicit in the Bible, but it does connect the dots of a lot of prophecies that are explicitly in the Bible, that a market crash or an economic crash in the United States would be the catalyst that would allow foreign powers like Europe to rise up and actually be able to militarily invade the United States. That's in the Bible about the military invasion. But you figure it's like, well, America's military is so much more powerful than its rivals. How is that ever going to happen? Mm. But a market crash is, like I said, as a personal prophecy from Mr. Herbert Armstrong, does fit the bill to allow those other Bible prophecies to be carried out.
There are several other nations that have been trying to get out from underneath the dominance of the dollar for quite some time, and they're taking measures to be able to do that. And the more you see these kinds of policies coming out from Washington, I think the harder they're going to work and the more urgent they're going to get about exactly that taking place. And once the dollar loses that reserve currency status, then the game changes entirely. Well, is Venezuela-style inflation coming to America? Is an article that we have up at thetrumpet.com, and we will link to it in the show notes for today's program. Thank you, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson. He who is not every day conquering some fear has not learned the secret of life. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.